You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and we are back to real talk for Indigenous peoples across the world, across the fourth world, across our world. We're speaking to Sunny Singh from the UK. We're going to talk about some floods that we've reported on our sites and on our Twitter feeds going on in India and South Asia. And we've reported it for the simple fact that it was an environmental issue, and we felt that it was connected to climate change, if you want to take the mainstream view, or global warming, which is our position on this, because of the damage that's being done by the capitalist machine to Mother Earth. However you want to look at it, as an Indigenous person, when you treat the water badly, it's hard for us to drink. You dig what I'm saying? When you treat the air badly, none of us can breathe. When you treat Mama Earth badly, she fights back. So this is what's happening. And we had a really massive flood come down on a hell of a lot of people in South Asia. And, you know, as our guest is going to come up and say, there wasn't a whole lot of news about it. There was news about the environmental damage because, let's face facts, Westerners on the liberal side are really concerned about the environment, but they really don't think about the Indigenous people in which the environment deals with. And, you know, there's a lot of capitalistic aspects to this. There's a lot of greed that's involved in this, and there's a lot of capitulation in terms of governments who are still, they still carry themselves as if they were being occupied. When they're really being occupied within their minds and spirits, and it's affecting the people in which they're supposed to represent. So this is Sunny Singh. She's a writer, she's a feminist, she's Desi, she's currently based in the UK, and she's probably the only person on the World Wide Web that is actually paying any real attention to this. And Sunny Singh, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
All right. So, you know, give us the background on this, because we don't have the information here. We know that there was a flood. We know that some people were displaced. We know that some farmers were really put into a bad way. But what's the real bottom line of what's going on in terms of numbers, in terms of people, and in terms of the causes of what, you know, is making the water flow the way it is in Southern Asia right now?
So let's go back and try to recap a little bit. Now, the major, let's say, trigger point on this has been a very early onset of the annual monsoon. Now, that we can always link back and say maybe this is part of climate change, or we can just say it's an anomaly. I don't want to, you know, argue about the science, but in the month of June, the region got about four times its normal rainfall that should happen in the month of June. Now, most of the region is prepared for it. Monsoons are heavy rainfall. We know that that happens. And, you know, you do expect a certain number of a certain amount of tragedy. People are swept away, rivers do flood, but not to the scale that it happens this time. Now, about 3 weeks ago, so we're now talking middle of June, starting about 15th, 16th, there was this massive rainfall that began, and it went on for days. Now, what that did was it eventually led to, or it impacted enough, that one of the glacial lakes broke through. Now we can again go back and look at the issues with glacier melting and the kinds of interventions humans have made in terms of stopping water flow and building on riverbeds or building in earthquake zones. Again, this area is very high earthquake probability zone, and not really following through on either geological concerns or environmental concerns. So down came this massive flood from this glacial lake, plus all of the rivers, you know, were swollen, and the ground was waterlogged. And what it did was the first point it hit was actually one of the most important religious site in India, which is Kedarnath. Now, it is not a site which is expected to get, has never in history gotten mass tourism. Mm-hmm. But in the last 20 years, as a combination of politicized religion, the Hindu nationalist idea, plus development, plus the sort of growing middle class that feels that it should go to this far-off remote mountain temple, it started getting yearly, annually, massive numbers. So you're already looking at numbers exceeding 300,000. No, actually, or more, possibly a million every year.
I would
year.
Think more, yeah.
And one of the water and the boulders and the silt and, the, you know, imagine this mad, raging mountain river racing downhill. It came down and it swept away quite a significant portion of the construction that was around the main temple. And further downhill, it swept away this whole huge town, which is, well, I can't say huge, it's not by any standard huge, but quite significant, called Rambara, which was sort of, it's a sort of stopgap area. It's where people stop before they get to the final temple. Now, having said that, this is the most badly impacted area, but there's an enormous number of other places that were hit. In this particular area, the temple of Kedarnath and immediately downstream from it, there were thousands of people. Often, many of them were stranded, often without food and water, without shelter for over 10 days until they could be gotten out by the army helicopter. This is not a region that you can access very, very easily. Very steep hills, very soft mountains. So the soil is not fully settled. Himalayas are the newest mountain range, in a sense, on the planet.
So in this case, the military was extremely helpful in assisting the local population in a time of crisis.
Well, in some ways, you know, the military, because the area is, you know, borders, it's on the border, the mountains are the northern border of India. There's an enormous number of people who are already there, and the military swung into action locally, trying to access people, but they weren't mobilized till almost a week later by the government, because the military itself can't mobilize. We're a democracy. They have to be ordered in. And the government waited for days before they actually moved people in. And you're looking at now, even the army said, you know, they evacuated something like 50,000 people, which is utter madness. Now, most of these people were not necessarily local. They were the pilgrims, the tourists, from all over India and all over the world. In fact, I mean, I was looking at the list, you know, the Americans, Swiss, Germans, Spanish, Chileans on that list.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, especially being that there was such an international crowd for what they knew was a spiritual / religious pilgrimage, why would the government hesitate to do everything they possibly could to reduce the amount of human casualties?
Well, hold on. There are two sides to it. I think a lot of people go up there for trekking and mountaineering as well. It's not the tourists, the pilgrims were the largest percentage of the people. But there's a lot of other people. And of course, the other part is that the locals have been very badly hit. In many cases, we're hearing that the locals opened up their kitchens, their homes, their grange granaries. They gave and they fed these stranded people for days and are now left with nothing. And there is still not enough help reaching them. And now they're starving because they played the Samaritans. So it's really quite a desperate situation. Now, the other side of it, and this is very crucial, the government has put in, apparently there are almost 3,000 projects for dams and, that are spread out over the region. Some of them have been complete, some are in progress, some are still planned. All these dams, or rather most of them, have been hugely contested by scientists, geologists, environmentalists. saying that these are the worst places for the campsite. The mountains and the terrain can't cope. But the government has gone ahead and built it. In many cases, the dams are handed out, the contracts are handed out to private companies.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, the Heidel projects, the Powell projects are managed and built and run by private companies. And in a sense, it's a nexus. The political structure is that gain, it's money, it's votes, it's a stage from corporate investment. And the corporate sector that is able to then conduct its business with political blessing and very little oversight.
How many of these investors are local in terms of being nationals to India, as opposed to, say, European, American, Canadian, British investment, Chinese investment?
I would not have the figures right off the bat. I would just completely, by looking at things, you are less likely to see Chinese investors, basically because it's a strategic border zone.
Mm-hmm.
So China is seen as a rival and not particularly a friendly nation, especially given the history of Chinese invasion in 1962.
Indeed.
So there is, but you are looking at large companies. I think more importantly, I think we know that, you know, even when so apparently a corporate is local or from a certain country, there's a good chance their backers, their investment, I mean, if you really track it all the way up, these are transnational.
Mm-hmm.
We have moved beyond in the capitalist system the moment where we can say this company belongs to such and such country. And maybe that's one of our problems, because the global elite is so removed from any interest in their own particular societies that they don't care.
Well, let me ask you an important...
That's part of the problem. Gets worse. You're going to be shocked at it.
Let me ask you an important question. Where does capitalism, in and of itself, beyond national borders, in terms of the entire global community, the concept or the ideology or the economic principle of capitalism, how does this bear on these floods, which we're sort of being told is a natural thing, and then say the Bangladesh, the two factories in Bangladesh that recently collapsed, the human toll. What does capitalism have to do with that? When we keep hearing that capitalism improves the world, what is the background on it?
Well, look, I mean, I have to turn around. I'm from the mountains. I live there. These are places that I have grown up in and I love. And the toll is emotionally and personally massive. Having said that, for as long as I can remember, for decades, the locals, and that includes people like me, have contested and tried to warn about the fact that the so-called development is not grassroots driven. The benefits don't accrue to the local people. Their livelihood, their homes, their lives are irrelevant to the so-called greater development, which is pumped in from elsewhere. Even now with the disaster, it's shocking and saddening that the government has made it very clear that the temple will be rebuilt and they're focused. I mean, it's a huge political game happening in India where everybody's talking about the temple and how it will be rebuilt. And not one person is willing to turn around and say, what about the human and human lives that has been consistently destroyed? I am, for all intents and purposes, very anti any kind of organized religion, because you can't put human, an invisible God and its rituals over the lives of human beings. Now, interestingly enough, there is another side to it spiritually, and what you said about the Mother Earth fighting back. The main temple in Kedarnath, it was almost entirely submerged at one point, and then the water flooded past it, was not swept away, was damaged, but was not destroyed by the boulder, so the flood or the silt that came down. And geologically, it's because of one of the few places in that little trough between the mountains, we stand safely. And this is a temple that's over 1,000 years old. Whoever built it took into account what the region was like. The local people say that this is the gods fighting back. That's why they the sort of destruction was rained down, because it's their revenge. So, you know, there is this sense that, you know, whatever has been done has not benefited the locals, has been a cost to the local population. And you're looking at small villages, you know, and I keep, you know, reports are horrific. A village of 700 people, 3 are alive after 10 days. And these are people in such remote parts of the mountains that few even come down to, you know, the big town. They're entirely ignored. They have no power to fight against the big corporate or the government or the big politics. Now, I'm not sure how we talk about capitalist benefits going to anyone when I look at the fact that this region has been completely demolished. And the rebuilding is again going to demolish the same people, because it will be again at their fault.
Yeah, this is a really devastating story. And for those of us in the fourth world, we really need to start, you know, looking at this and trying to find out as much as we can, because if we're going to expect the mainstream news agencies, especially in the West, to talk about this, it's simply not going to happen. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking with Sunny Singh, writer, activist. We're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
But the message is that there are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know. And each year we discover a few more of those unknown unknowns.
This is Radio Angra Indian. Angra Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेकथ्रू की पहल।
There are many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged, those who can't afford good legal counsel, those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the US, capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait, sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong, the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and FirstVoicesIndigenousRadio.org.
HIV संक्रमित हरुलाई माया ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरुको अपेक्षा होइन अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौं, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरूलाई मात्र होइन तपाईलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
My name is Nicholas Soames. I'm the Member of Parliament for Mid Sussex and I am the grandson of Winston Churchill. I've decided to lend my strongest possible support to this campaign because I am appalled by the dishonesty and the disgraceful way in which the British National Party have used Churchill's name, particularly during the European election where they used his face, his features, his words as promotional literature, trying to pretend that Churchill would have admired and supported the aims of the British National Party. What they have done is not only dishonest and irresponsible, but it's downright misleading to try and pretend that Churchill would have had any sympathy with the British National Party, whatever. He would, I can assure you, have loathed everything that they stand for. Churchill led a national government. He was acutely conscious, as Britain's war leader, of the need to have a national government, to bring all parties together. And yet what the BNP seek to do is to divide all parties, to bring division and upset and lack of coherence to our communities by driving wedges between people. That is the exact opposite of everything that Churchill wanted to do in the national government. This is a peaceful country, and what they bring to it is uncertainty, fear, and confusion. There is absolutely nothing that is British about the BNP.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
Radio Intelligente
The broadcast that works to keep the fourth world informed. Radio Intelligente Rindijina. Internet radio for intelligent aboriginals.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. Well, we're still speaking to Sunny Singh about the human tragedy that is going on in South Asia that not only the Western press is ignoring, but the Indian press is ignoring. The entire Asian press is ignoring, right? The global press, for the most part, has moved on, in her words. You know, we're going to talk now about what the journalism, or what is supposed to be journalism, is focusing on in this crisis. Sunny, you know, you told me something very interesting during the break. Yeah, could you relate the story for our listeners, please?
Yes, of course. I think the issue is the sort of trivialization of the news, of the press refusing to do its job in terms of actually reporting or analyzing what's happened. So very few are really talking about the environmental issues. Even fewer are talking about the levels of government corruption and the role of political leaders and corporate leaders in this man-made tragedy. But worse is that it's the sort of superficial, so-called human angle they find. So the biggest hit has been this Hindu pilgrimage site, Kedarnath. One of the pilots who's been Air Force guys who's been ferrying people in and out, evacuating, was one of the first officers then, was actually interviewed by one of the national newspapers and was asked what he felt as a Muslim rescuing people of another faith. And his answer was perfect. And he said, you know, in the Indian army, we are taught one faith, and that's being Indian. And yet the fact that it got, that a journalist not only thought it was appropriate to ask the question, but actually filed the story and ran with the story with that. There are how I've been tweeting in, you know, videos of one television journalist sitting on top of the shoulders of a poor local man who's standing knee deep in water, reporting, and you can see in the offcut before they focus in on his face that he's actually physically sitting on top of someone else, another human being, and holding a mic, reporting. And the kinds of brutality that have gone with the media reporting has been extraordinary. And journalists yelling at soldiers whose families are dead as to why they are taking up room instead of saving and evacuating people or evacuating them. Journalists taking up room in helicopter, which could have been probably used for something else. Mm-hmm. And you do realize that there is there's a horrific immorality to it.
After looking at this, would you consider India to be in a post-colonial state?
Well, I think we are probably, if we were ever post-colonial, I think we have reached the kinds of immoral fourth estate or immoral press, corporate-driven, corporate-owned, that any other part of the so-called developed world has. We may not have gotten developed any other way, but that we've managed to get very well. What's also shocking to me is the complete lack of attention by the so-called social media celebrities or just anybody, political leaders, political parties, celebrities. They're just ignoring them. And you brought up Bangladesh before and what happened in the textile factory. And I think the biggest difference is that this is so remote. The mountains are so far away. There are no easy images of, people. You can't roll out of your wonderful car out of the 5-star hotel, do 2 hours of reporting, and then go back to your 5-star hotel and have a beer. If you want to report on this, you really have to be dedicated. And frankly, what we're seeing is no part of the corporate media.
Well, aside from yourself, can you think of any independent journalists that are working on this?
Well, there's quite a few Indian ones who are working on it. Small, generally from small newspapers or local newspapers. Quite a few of them are on my Twitter feed. They're reporting on it. There's a lot of NGO and bloggers and volunteers who are working on it. And in so many ways, it's been a lot of the small, really, really the grassroots have gotten through it. But what's shocking and sad is that it hasn't hit the big numbers. So in a sense, the mobilization is small. You know, if you had 5 or 6 or 7 major journalists talking about it, if you had some of the celebrities talking about it, we know how this works in the real world, right, in 2013. These people matter. You know, Justin Bieber tweets one thing, it becomes major news. And if those were the people paying attention, maybe the ones, the volunteers and the locals, the small journalists, the NGOs would not be struggling so much to just get some attention.
Well, how can individual bloggers and independent news agencies that, you know, deal with indigenous issues, how can we help the people who are being affected by this?
Well, I would turn around and say make a lot of noise. The more noise we make, the more often we talk about it. That's what I've been doing. I mean, my Twitter feed for the last 3 weeks has been nothing but Uttarakhand, basically. All the hashtags, if you go through it, probably 90% of it is that. We have volunteers who have not slept in days. You will be shocked that in 2013, we have in India a government, a state government, that is making lists of the rescued and missing and the dead by hand on little sheets of paper in almost illegible writing. And then the worst thing is, you know, they're uploading this onto the government website as PDF. So they scan it, upload it, and there is no way for any other human being to be able to make sense of it. So for the last 2 weeks, we have a group of volunteers from Twitter. We are not organized. We are not a group. We just came together as just out of humanity to turn around and say this needs to be made available to people who are looking. So now we have volunteers who are taking down these, you know, searching for these files, because the government moves the URLs every couple of days for some unfathomable reason. And we are translating these. We're going through, checking against the names, checking their duplications, they're badly collated. I mean, it's impossible. And then we have set up databases that can be searched. So this is happening at a very small citizen level. And I think if we had even a little bit of attention from the media, from bloggers, from people, from just independent, news sources, we maybe are able to get to more people. I have given up that New York Times will care, or even, frankly, Times of India will care. But perhaps more people could get involved if they knew about it. And at this point, most people don't know about it. We discussed it a little before in the program, and that so little news is available that very few people even know this has happened.
Well, I want to make it clear to our listeners here, the Aboriginal Press News Service wouldn't really know about the human toll if it wasn't for Sunny Singh, because her Twitter feed, SunnySingh_NW3, is probably the only news source that I've seen that is continuing to discuss what's happening. You can find the environmental blogs and news sites that are concerned with environmental change, that they have noted this, but they really have not talked about the people after the tragedy has occurred. Thank you, Sunny Singh, for giving us the lowdown on this, and we would like you to come back and keep us informed, you know, whenever you get a chance to give us some information on what's going on.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I know it probably sounded a little bit more impassioned and potentially more like a rant, but I think many of us who are from that region are despairing of any support and any help from outside, and we can get any kind of help and any kind of support, we would appreciate it a great deal. So right. Thank you very much.
Of course, always. That was Sunny Singh reporting from the British Empire. Her website is sunnysinghonline.blogspot.com. And as I said earlier, you can check out her Twitter feed on sunnysinghn3, all in one straight word. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I hope you have picked up some information from this, because we certainly did. We've only been able to report about the actual incident, not how it affected Indigenous people after the water stopped flowing. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो?
थाहा छ, सन् 1988 मा।
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए? सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए? कसले के गरे?
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं? तपाईले गर्नुभयो?
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं, जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
I'm gonna stand until I can't stand no more. If I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
We're the hood librarians, we ship the prisons too. We reach out and deliver to those that's bitten too, but it's more than a bookstore. You want it, we got it. Mixtapes, DVDs, and culture products. Black and Nobel got our hands in a lot of projects. You rock them all to come build, the energy is positive. And remember, other teams, there's awakened conscious. Come through and experience this place of knowledge that they don't put it in a book. If they want to hide it from us, but we got the book so you can buy it from us. Something to read while you're on a train or riding the bus. Get your read on, food for thought, get your eat on.
Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor Indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all Indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
Thank you.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
India, Dalits on World's Anti-Racism Agenda. One of the most controversial items on the agenda at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban in September 2003 was whether discrimination against the Dalit or untouchable communities in India should be mentioned in the final document. Tinku Ray reports. This item was first published on the 2nd of September 2003. Throughout India, the Dalit communities, once known as untouchables, are getting organized. Their status in society is so low that they come below the lowest caste in the caste system and are often relegated to doing the most menial jobs imaginable. Although the Indian constitution makes it illegal to discriminate against someone on the basis of their caste, in practice it is still widespread, especially in rural areas. That's why Dalit activists decided to put their fight on the world stage and tried to get the oppression of Dalits debated at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban in September 2003. The Indian government fought hard against this and strongly denies that casteism is an international racism issue. It looks like the government may have won the argument. The final document, still unedited, has removed all traces of the issue. Tinku Ray investigates both sides of the story. She begins her report in one village where earlier this summer, extreme discrimination against Dalits led to murder.
The village of Kalwakal is just 160 kilometers from Andhra Pradesh's state capital, Hyderabad. Earlier this summer, on the night of July 25th, this village was the scene of a gruesome murder. 30-year-old Balaswamy was dragged from his home, severely beaten and then burnt alive. His crime? He was a Dalit who had spoken out against the oppression of his community in the village. 500 people watched the act and no one came to his aid, except for Balaswamy's father, Iranna, who remembers that night with tears. As soon as I heard my son was being beaten, I rushed to the spot, says Iranna. But they beat me as well, until I collapsed and I could do nothing to save him. Iranna, an agricultural labourer, has given the police a list of names of the men who carried out the attack, all of them from higher castes. The family took me to the place where Balaswamy was burnt. His wife, Guruvamma, wept uncontrollably at the scene. This is not the first such incident in Kalwakal, a village like thousands of others in India, where the caste system and its customs are still practiced. A system that keeps Dalits in a state of extreme poverty. Dalits live in a separate part of the village. They cannot own land or use the same wells as the other castes and have to stay at a distance when talking to members of the upper castes. A song praising leaders who have fought for the cause of Dalit emancipation. And through affirmative action and quotas, Dalits have been able to better themselves. Fed up of being treated as less than human, they have begun to fight back. Dalit rights are human rights. Durban victory is Dalit victory. Just a couple of the slogans raised at this rally in Andhra Pradesh. It was to celebrate the inclusion of the whole issue of caste at the Durban conference. Although the word caste has not been included, the phrase work and descent-based discrimination is, which in essence means caste. The celebrations were led by colourfully dressed Dalit drummers. Paul Divakar is leader of the National Campaign for Dalit Human Rights and has strong views that the oppression of Dalits should be included on any international human rights agenda.
Generational genocide of Dalits have taken place over the ages. Not just one, not just twice. Generational genocide has taken place. So it's only natural that when you really do have access to these international human rights instruments, finally, people cannot close their eyes because our voice, a feeble voice has become a very threatening voice to those perpetrators of the human rights violations.
I think it's a category mistake to confuse caste with race. Race is a biological category and caste is a social category.
Veteran Indian sociologist Andre Bette has been very critical of the way the UN conference is trying to expand the whole concept of race.
If you want to discuss all forms of discrimination, there are 153 different forms of discrimination. You dilute it to such an extent that it loses focus altogether. I did read the UN document fairly carefully at a certain time, and it in fact expands the definition of racial discrimination to include discrimination on the basis of ethnicity, nationality, which I think is disastrous.
The Indian government is strongly opposed to making the issue of caste an international racism issue. It claims the government has done and is still dealing positively with the Dalit issue. Convener of the National Campaign for Dalit Human Rights, Martin Makwan, argues that getting their cause noticed is the first step towards getting rid of the discrimination.
We are not saying that caste is race. That's not our position. We are believing that discrimination should be eliminated at all, because that is what is the mandate of the Indian Constitution that we have. We supported the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s. We supported anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Now when it comes to supporting the caste issue, India is saying this is internal matter.
Back in the home of Balaswamy, the race conference in Durban seems very far away. Balaswamy's father is proud of his son for fighting for Dalit rights, and he hopes that those efforts will help towards breaking the horrific cycle of abuse and discrimination.
From north to south, from east to west, the folks who want the best, listen to Internet Radio for smarter, the original.